thank you so much for being here. I am going to go through chapters 11 through 15, and would love to have some time for discussion today, because this is all about making it yours. This is all about making the conversations valuable, not only to you, but also to the teachers that you supervise. I think often we want to make them valuable to the teacher, but we don't necessarily think about the value to ourselves. So we want to make sure that we're hitting both sides of that coin today. And I would love to have your thoughts, your questions as we go along. And I think we've got a reasonably sized group to allow some good discussion. So as I mentioned before, everybody was here. Heather is not joining us tonight just because of the time zone. It's very late where she is. And we didn't want her to have too late a night for the early start that she has. So let's go ahead and get right to it. Welcome everyone to week three of our Now We're Talking book study. I'm your host, Justin Bader. And today our focus is on high impact instructional conversations. We'll be going through chapters 11 through 15. And these chapters are all about good conversations, about the kinds of conversations that actually change teacher practice, that actually strengthen relationships and give you insight into teacher thinking and allow you to see that whole iceberg of teacher practice. So you can see the chapters there. I know you've been listening to them or reading them or reviewing them. And we're going to jump right in to chapter 11 here as we circle around this theme of conversation. So chapter 11 is all about going beyond what I think are the common purposes that principals seem to want to achieve when they get into classrooms. I see a lot of interest in data collection. I see a lot of interest in giving feedback. And neither of those is really a primary focus of the model that we're talking about in this book. And this chapter makes the case as to why that is. And we talk about how both data collection and that feedback sandwich process can undermine those authentic professional conversations. And I think one of the questions that we've got to really ask ourselves is who is all this for? And I would love to have some of your comments in the chat. Who in your perspective, feel free to just unmute, we're a small group, who are classroom walkthroughs really for? And I love that that Latin phrase, qui bono, who benefits? Who are they for? Jennifer, what do you think?
I think it depends on the purpose, and I've readjusted my expectations where I now know when I walk through with a group of my school leaders from another campus onto another campus, it's for a different purpose than if I am the school leader on that campus. If that's the case, then I'm walking through for the benefit of the teacher. I've had an adjustment of thinking for sure.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Anybody else have a thought to share there? Shanita or anyone else who's here? Valerie, Inez, Kristen?
I think it benefits everybody involved. The teacher, because they get an opportunity to really reflect on their practice, the instructional leader so that they know what's going on in the classroom, and then whatever decisions they come to together, it benefits the students.
Well said. And I appreciate that focus on decision-making, both for ourselves and for teachers. Yeah, it seems to me like a lot of the driver of walkthroughs is, you know, a central office administrator who wants data. And I think that's an understandable goal. But I think primarily it's those other groups. It's teachers, it's students, it's yourselves, it's people on your campus that are going to benefit. And of course, your boss is going to have an easier job of doing what they do if you're in classrooms a lot, but it may not be because you're collecting data. And I actually have pretty strong opinions about this as a researcher, you know, having designed some protocols for collecting data, having had data collected on me by researchers who are in the same PhD program I was while I was a principal, and just looking at what they had to do to go around and collect data from people. It was things that I could not do as a principal simply because of my schedule, because of my position. So I really have pretty strong feelings that data is not the best thing for us to be doing. Collecting data is not the best thing for us to be doing. And if you need people to collect data, there are always researchers who need a project, right? There are thousands and thousands of people doing doctoral programs who need a research project. So it is definitely worth looking elsewhere other than principles for collecting data. And I think when we give ourselves data to collect, you know, often this impetus comes from us. We're the ones who want to collect data because we want to make improvement decisions. But I think the best way to do that is holistically rather than with those blinders on. You know, anytime you have a form you're filling out, anytime you're looking for one particular thing, you may be able to get a good sense of that thing, but it may not turn out to be the most important thing. So I think we do the best and we have the greatest impact when, generally speaking, we go in without those blinders on, without a specific focus. At least, you know, I think it's okay to have a focus if you have a very specific purpose. Like if you say, you know what, we're going to adopt a new literacy curriculum, I need to go into classrooms and look for what our current practices. I need to understand what we're currently doing so that we can make this decision about a new curriculum. I think there are situations where it makes sense to do that. But for the most part, I think we're better off if we go in completely open to what I call the teacher's instructional purpose, right? What is the teacher trying to accomplish with this part of the lesson that I'm seeing? If I have some vision of a perfect lesson in my head and I expect to see that exact thing when I walk into the classroom, and I don't really think, well, what is this teacher trying to accomplish today? Where are they in the unit? What do their students need? What have they found from assessments? Where are they going in this, you know, this unit? If I don't think about any of those questions and I just have this model of a perfect lesson in my head, I'm always going to be disappointed. And my feedback is usually not going to be helpful to teachers. I think if we're willing to get into teachers' heads and say, okay, where are you? What's your purpose? You know, what are you working on? Then we can serve as that thought partner. We can serve as that sounding board and, you know, be useful in those conversations. So that's why I'm not real big on data or using walkthroughs to collect data. I think data is very useful in other ways. And I'm not real big on the good old feedback sandwich. And you've probably heard me talk about the feedback sandwich, a good old Arby's compliment, suggestion, compliment. And, you know, I think that that structure feels complete to us because we like things that have three in them. You know, it just feels good, you know, to have an opening, a middle paragraph and a conclusion. You know, it's in essay structure. It's in a lot of different things. I teach a three-part structure in our interview trainings for the job search. But I think in a feedback conversation, it just makes things a little weird. And if you think about your personal life, it would be difficult to receive a feedback sandwich from someone in your personal life about, you know, your driving or your cooking or whatever you're wearing. Like, it would just be weird. And if you don't believe me, try it. Like, I really challenge you to try this because it's so normal in our profession and yet so weird in our personal lives. I just think we do better to avoid that that weird and kind of inauthentic structure. The next question I wanted to pose for you is, what does the teacher actually want feedback on? And I'd love to hear from people who are joining us live. Have teachers asked you for feedback on particular things? Have you ever had a teacher come up to you and say, hey, I'm doing X, you know, could I have your feedback on that? Has that ever happened to you, Jennifer or Shanita or anybody else who's here with us? Okay. What do you think?
Only when they want to show something off, and it's not really for feedback though.
Yeah. And I think that's what most people want most of the time, right? It's like they don't actually want suggestions. They just want to be noticed. Like, hey, I'm putting in a lot of effort to get good at something or to try something new. I'm taking a risk and I just want to be noticed. And I think that is valuable. I think that is a gift that we can give people. And I am trying to let someone in here and my list keeps popping around. So hopefully they will be back if we just lost someone. Hey, Valerie, hope you're doing well. All right. So my suggestion in this chapter is really to not worry about suggestions. Don't see suggestions as the heart of this process. See it as okay to go in, to talk with the teacher, to have a good conversation, to be that sounding board, but not to actually make any suggestions. And I want to ask you to think for a second and respond in the chat, at least if you would, or on camera if you'd like. What's so hard about that? Why is it so difficult for us to not make a suggestion? This seems to be very deeply ingrained in our profession. And I would love to have your thoughts about why that is. Why do we love giving suggestions? Because like, this is weird to me because like, we know it's hard, right? We know how hard it is, especially to give a very strong teacher a suggestion for improvement. Kristen says, we want to fix things. Yeah, absolutely. It feels good to fix things. Valerie says, it seems we're supposed to have the answers. Yeah, absolutely. And certainly that's a big part of like our establishing our credibility, right? Is we want to seem like we have the answers, right? We want to seem like we know what we're talking about. We want to actually know what we're talking about. And yet I think sometimes acting like we know what we talk about inhibits actually figuring out what we need to know what we're talking about. And I think about my experience as a new principal who had never been an elementary teacher. I'd been a middle school teacher, became an elementary principal. I just didn't know a lot about, you know, teaching the primary grades, teaching reading. And if I had acted like I did, I don't know that I would have really ever learned much if I had just kind of faked my way into it. So this is an approach that I, you know, really didn't have an alternative to. But I think even if you do have extensive background knowledge, it can result in a lot more learning on your part. Shanita says power and authority. Do you want to say more about that, Shanita? Why is this so hard for us to not make suggestions?
Well, I've run into administrators. They think because they're the principal, they're supposed to tell you what you're doing wrong or tell you the right way or tell you what to do or how to do it. They just feel that way because they're the boss. I don't think they would do it if they didn't feel, you know, if they weren't feeling like I'm the boss, I have to tell you what to do and you have to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I think the proof of that is they probably don't do that in their personal life, maybe with their kids, but not with their spouse or, you know, it just does not work. So again, to leave you, thank you for your comments there, to leave you with some takeaways for chapter 11. I think this is really all about just noticing what the teacher's trying to do, making the conversation authentic, letting go of the need to make suggestions, and thinking about the teacher as a self-directed learner, right? Teachers are professionals. We want to make sure that they're engaging in reflection on the right issues, that they are thinking about their practice and how that practice can improve, but not necessarily because of our brilliant suggestions. And, you know, none of that is to say, if you have a great suggestion, that you should keep it to yourself, right? If you have a great suggestion, you think the moment is right, you think the teacher will be receptive to it, great. What I'm saying here is that often we don't, right? Often things are fine. You're not sure what you would do differently. It's just kind of fine. You don't have to force yourself to come up with something. Just have a conversation. And I think often that is more valuable. So let's take a look at chapter 12 next, which is all about evidence-based questions. And we'll let some people in here. Welcome, welcome. So chapter 12 is all about genuine evidence-based questions and grounding our conversations in that specific evidence. And I think evidence is really what allows us to break out of this kind of head-to-head battle of opinions that we tend to get stuck in, you know, that kind of butting heads, like, here's what I thought you could have done better. And then the teacher wants to look, you know, competent and, you know, confident, and they kind of push back and say, no, I think I actually did a really good job of that. And we have this kind of back and forth of, was it good enough? No, it wasn't. Yes, it was. That's the kind of, you know, head-to-head conflict that is not necessarily going to result in learning or growth. And I think one of the two major components for getting out of that head-butting approach is evidence. And I think evidence is a tricky concept because we want to be serious enough, right? We want to take the evidence that we're looking at seriously. We want to take teacher practice seriously, but we don't want to raise the stakes so high that it's threatening to people, right? We don't want to put people on the defensive. And we know people are already on the defensive in the formal observation process, right? There's a certain degree to which that's unavoidable when we're doing evaluations. And if we're going to be getting into classrooms frequently and doing lots of walkthroughs and, you know, just giving people feedback on a much more regular basis, we don't want their threat level to be elevated. We don't want that whole walkthrough process to be threatening to teachers. So we've got to be really careful about not scaring teachers. And for that reason, I recommend not even using the word evidence. Like, we don't want to say, hey, I've got some evidence for you, or I've got some evidence on you, or some evidence about you. Just say, you know, I took some notes. Here's what I noticed today. So think of this in terms of noticing and notes rather than evidence. Now, you've probably seen the evidence-driven questions. You've seen the note cards. We've got this as a separate PDF. We've got this on the back of the note cards. These are everywhere on our website. So if you have not seen these, here they are. They're in these chapters as well. But on the note cards, there's a little title for each question. The titles are not in the book because we came up with those later. But these questions focus you on a piece of evidence and then allow the teacher to start talking about that evidence. And you see there's a little place for the brackets there. And what my hope is for these questions is that they allow you to set a direction, to refer to specific evidence, and maybe even to describe that evidence using framework language, which we'll talk about later, but then zip it, and just let the teacher run with it, because I think that's when we learn the most. And that's when we get the best teacher reflection, is when we allow ourselves to not have all the answers, to not have all the suggestions, but to really let the teacher talk. So a couple of things about these questions that you will notice, and a couple of characteristics of good and bad questions. First of all, good questions are genuine. They're open. You know, we're open to hearing different perspective. We're open to questioning our assumptions. And if we do have assumptions or thoughts to share, we state those directly. And I think when we're direct in what we're thinking, we're direct in what we're wondering, we can avoid some of the kind of leading or didactic questions, or the kind of, you know, quizzing the teacher one question at a time to get them to a particular conclusion that we think we've already decided on. We really want to leave the door open to going in directions that we hadn't thought of. And I think anytime we're talking with a teacher about their practice, you remember the visual of the iceberg? Remember the metaphor of the iceberg where 90% of it's hidden beneath the surface? That tip of the iceberg that's above the surface is there so we have something tangible to talk about. Like, the reason we're getting into classrooms, even though 90% of what we're going to encounter is hidden, you know, 90% of teacher practice is hidden, the reason we still get into classrooms and not just say, well, I don't even need to be in classrooms because I won't see anything that matters anyway, is so that we do have something to talk about and something to start the conversation in a particular direction. So I'm curious as to some of your thoughts about genuine questions here. Let me get some of your reactions as far as those genuine questions. Was this part of how you received instructional leadership as a teacher, how you were supervised? What was your experience with the types of questions that you were asked as a teacher? Because I think so much of how we approach our work is shaped either positively or negatively. You know, sometimes we do the opposite of how we were treated. But I'd love to know your perspective on that. How were you treated in terms of questioning as a teacher? What kind of questions were asked of you? Feel free to unmute there. Jennifer, do you want to say something? Feel free to unmute if you do. And I'd love to hear, I know a lot of people have their cameras off and that's fine, but I would love to hear from you if you're able to share. Valerie says, questions were very pointed and exact. And Valerie, it sounds like you're saying that there was like an expected correct answer. Yeah, okay. Thank you for that. What was your experience? Let us know of being questioned. Kristen says, I don't remember being asked questions as a teacher. Admin came in so rarely. Yeah, does that sound familiar? Once a year, maybe. Like, hi, I'm here. I have to do your evaluation. I have another one in 15 minutes. Sign this paper and I'll see you next year. Like, there's a lot of that in our profession, certainly. Yeah. Jennifer, any thoughts on that? Or Shanita, any further thoughts on
that? Yeah, I do feel that is oftentimes the case. And just being a teacher with administrators walking in the room, and oftentimes they didn't know what to say to you. So they just kind of checkmarked the form on whether you're proficient or not in a certain area. And it was off and running for the rest of the year. And very rarely did you see them. So I love having the open-ended and having a conversation. So I think our teachers appreciate it more too, because they know that you're not there to get them for something that they may have done wrong. Or, and honestly, I think that they're scared when we're first walking in the room so often, because they don't know what you're there for originally until after they get used to you being in there more than what they have expected in the past.
Yeah. Yeah. And that fear is real, right? Because they get an evaluation, they can get fired, they can, you know, bad things can happen. And I think it is our job, I don't know if I say this in the book, but I think it's really our job to minimize teacher anxiety and not just tell teachers, well, don't be nervous when I'm walking in your room with a big nasty pad of paper. You know, it's our job to make them not nervous by the way that we treat them as professionals. So specifically when it comes to taking notes and gathering evidence in walkthroughs, I think it's really important that we explain what we're doing, we explain what we're not doing, and we not keep anything secret. So you want to tell people, you know, hey, I'm going to be taking notes. You don't necessarily want to do that in your very first couple of cycles. In fact, I recommend that you don't take any notes at all until your third cycle. So get around to every teacher once very quickly, get around to every teacher a second time, a little more slowly, you know, 5, 10, 15 minutes, stay a little bit longer, talk a little bit. And not until that third cycle do I recommend taking notes. And then you want to keep those notes low inference. You want to keep them descriptive so that it's just the facts. You know, you're just taking, you know, running record or transcript of, you know, everything you're seeing and hearing as much as you can. And you want to give those notes to the teacher right away. And I feel very strongly that it should just be notes and not a form. Again, because I think the form, you've heard me talk about forms probably more than you wanted to, but I really feel like they introduce a layer of formality and they really take a lot of the relationship out of it. So it's going to be much more, it's just going to connect a lot better, I think, if it's just notes. And, you know, I know a lot of people like handwriting. I really prefer email simply because it's easier to share. It's easier for the teacher to read. They don't have to decipher. You know, my handwriting is not going to win any awards. So I am partial to email. And of course, if you're using repertoire, that makes it very easy to email your notes to the teacher. But before you start doing that, you may want to announce to the teachers that you're going to start taking notes. And you don't want to make a huge deal about this, but you just want to give people a heads up and let them know that they are not being singled out. So I'll put this in the slides if you'd like to refer to this later, but just a kind of a quick email template where you can just let your staff know, hey, I'm going to be taking some notes. I don't want you to not know, like, I don't want you to wonder what I'm writing down. So I'll share with you what I'm writing down. And then you can let me know if I missed anything, things like that, just to give people a little bit of power in this, right? To keep them from being in the dark and feeling like they're being targeted or you're building some sort of secret folder of data about them to use against them. You do want to be very careful not to say, hey, these walkthroughs are non-evaluative. You want to be really careful not to make that promise that these are non-evaluative. And even if your intent is not for these to be evaluative, the reality is everything is evaluative, right? Like when you're the supervisor, everything plays into the evaluation in some way, even if officially only formal evaluations count. You know, you just don't want to promise this is not evaluative because you may have to at some point use something that you see, and you may want to use something you see in a positive way in the evaluation. So don't call them non-evaluative. You also want to be careful not to promise anything specific like nobody else will see these notes, because, like, frankly, if they do something illegal, you're probably going to have to show them to HR and your boss. So, like, just avoid some of those pitfalls. Keep it low key. You know, it's not going to be a big deal. And then I think finally for chapter 12, we want to emphasize that, you know, when we're gathering evidence, the evidence itself is not everything. So we want to look for ways to put that evidence in context. We want to get a sense of how what we saw fits with everything else. And we want to evaluate the lesson's success, not evaluate the teacher in that moment, but we want to, you know, get a sense of how well things went based on what the teacher was trying to accomplish in the first place, not some sort of predetermined checklist. And again, we want to be very careful not to say this was satisfactory or this was, you know, exemplary or whatever. We're not there to evaluate the teacher in specific lessons. We're going to do that later. We want to keep this feeling as non-evaluative as possible, even though we've not promised to make it non-evaluative. So in our chapter 12 action challenge, some of the things that I challenge you to do in this chapter are to be more specific in what you're bringing up, what you're noting in your notes, what you're mentioning in your questions. Don't use the word evidence. I think it's not a helpful word. Just send the message that you're paying attention. You're being more specific in what you're noticing. You're using those 10 questions to ask good evidence-based conversations. And then starting in that third cycle, you're actually providing those written notes. And in terms of providing feedback, I really see those notes as the feedback. You know, if you think about feedback as an audio term, right? What comes through in feedback, right? If I were to rig up my mic and play a loud sound to play feedback, it would be that sound itself feeding back through, right? It's like when we provide feedback to teachers, we're just, you know, returning to them what we're seeing in their own practice, right? It's not outside commentary. It's not, you know, hey, I read an article the other day. It's returning to the teacher what the teacher was doing, and it's being that extra set of eyes. So those notes really are the feedback. All right, jump in anytime with questions here, but we're going to zip right ahead to chapter 13, if I can get my my slides to advance here. And if you've just joined us, welcome. Thank you so much for being here. Feel free to pop in with comments or questions in the chat or unmute if you would like. Chapter 13 brings in the second part of taking opinion out of these conversations and making it much more, much less a battle of wills or a tug of war, and making it much more of an objective discussion about the evidence. And of course, we can never be truly objective, but we can bring in a third party perspective. And if we think about like a courtroom, right? In a courtroom, you have the facts of the case, you have the evidence, which we've already talked about, but you also have the law, right? A courtroom can't really function if there's no evidence or if there's no law. You need both pieces. And the instructional framework, which we're talking about in this chapter, essentially serves as the law, right? It serves as our definition of good practice. It serves as our kind of vision for improvement. And we want that to be something that's outside of ourselves so that it's not just a battle of opinions. Because if we're engaged in a battle of opinions, the problem is we have conflicting incentives as teachers and administrators, right? We both want to demonstrate competence, but we do that in different ways. Like the teacher wants to demonstrate competence by doing a good job, having us tell them they did a good job, and having us leave quickly, right? As quickly as possible. They want to get on with their day. But for us to demonstrate competence, sometimes we feel like we have to find something the teacher did wrong that they could do better, that they could improve. So we have this built-in kind of conflict in this relationship where they're trying to look perfect and we're trying to point out that they're not perfect and find something in which they can grow. And I think we can do better than that. I think we can break out of that paradigm a little bit by using a framework as an arbiter, as a third party in the conversation that can say, here's what good practice looks like, here's what it doesn't look like, and here's what we can compare the evidence against. So again, it's kind of like the law in a courtroom. And of course, we want to be much more low-key about it. We don't want to make this a threatening or high-stakes thing, especially if you're using language other than your actual evaluation criteria. And I was talking with Shanita about this a little bit earlier today. You don't actually have to use your evaluation criteria in these conversations, especially if they're in flux right now, if your state's adopting something new, if your district's adopting something new, and that's just kind of a hot topic that you don't want to really mess with right now. You don't have to use your evaluation criteria. You could very well use someone else's evaluation criteria. And the lovely thing about the era that we live in now is every state's evaluation criteria are available online. You can get evaluation criteria from Canada. You can get them from Australia. I was looking at Australia's last month for a group that I've got going in the Adelaide area. So you can look all across the profession to find sources of professional language. And I would love to hear what some of your favorite sources are. I've got some examples on the screen, but what are some sources of professional language that have proven helpful to you or that could be helpful to you in having feedback conversations with teachers? What are some specific sources? Think about that for a moment. Let me know in the chat or out loud, and I'll wait for a few responses on this.
We use our Florida school leadership standards that help us to drive down the importance in our schools. I work for a charter school organization, so we also have our own framework of instruction. So a lot of that goes into our teachers' evaluation because we have, six measures of excellence that we like to make sure we're drilling down into our school. So we have a couple outside frameworks coming in. And then of course our school excellence plan, which is similar to a school improvement plan. So those things kind of drive a lot of what we're looking for with teachers.
Perfect. Love it. Thank you, Jennifer. Great, great. What else do you have? Somebody else, let me know what you have. And while someone else is working up the courage to speak, I'll give a couple examples from Seattle Public Schools. We had a document called High Leverage Moves that was 8 strategies that the district had done a lot of PD on. They'd taught and modeled those strategies, and teachers were expected to be fluent with them. Valerie says, I tend to use our district's framework just for common language. Yeah, absolutely. So having that common language is essential. Even if it's not common yet, if you're the only one in your district who's doing this, it's okay to start introducing that common language. But yeah, certainly if there's something in place already, you want to use that. Anything school-based, anything from a particular curriculum. And then as Jennifer said, anything from your school improvement plan could be great as well. Let's see. I think it would be good. Shanita, remind me at the end. We can pull up the standards you sent me earlier today and look at those at the end. If you want, I'll pull up our the link that you sent me, because I think that would be good to look at as well and talk about how to use that. And then all of this you can put into repertoire. Again, you don't have to quote the specific standard you're using in order to use that language in the conversation. Kristen says, our teacher evaluation rubric would be some of the language. And we have a district emphasis on PLCs this year. So we talk about the four questions and the essential standards and learning targets. Good stuff, good stuff. Valerie says, have you some of Marzano's resources? Yeah, so I mean, there are lots of sources of this professional language. And what you'll find is, you know, I look at a lot of them and honestly, they're all fine, right? A lot of them overlap. What we can get from those various sources is precise, rich, descriptive language. Right? You know how if you're describing something and you have a good vocabulary, you could think of many different words to describe something, right? It works kind of the same way with professional vocabulary, that the more vocabulary we have, the more precise we can be. And we don't even have to use, you know, one thing rather than the other. If we have a variety of good language at our disposal. A couple of things to look for. When it comes to the types of language and the types of instruments we're using when we get into classrooms, again, not a big fan of checklists or rubrics that ask you to rate the frequency with which you're seeing things. I think we lose a lot qualitatively when we focus too much on quantity or on tallying or scoring. So again, I'm very anti-form when it comes to this. When it comes to looking for a particular practice, I think we've got to be really thoughtful about when that practice should be used, when it would be wise for the teacher to use that practice. Otherwise, teachers will just use a practice whenever we walk into the room, and then that kind of ruins our data collection, right? Like that's a huge validity problem. If you think you're sampling, with the strategies that people are using, and then they just use those strategies whenever you walk into the room, you're gonna say, oh, they use it 100% of the time, great. That's the dog and pony show, right? This is not really authentic. And then grain size has to do with the idea that sometimes what we're evaluating is very big picture, but of course our evidence might be very small slices of time. So when it comes to things like teachers' content knowledge, right? We do evaluate teachers based on their content knowledge. That's a part of most teacher evaluation systems, but it wouldn't really be appropriate to go into a classroom one time and to see a teacher make one mistake and evaluate them for the entire year as unsatisfactory in content knowledge because I made one mistake, right? We want to get a sense of the things that we're evaluating over the course of many visits, many observations, the longer time frame, and not try to evaluate based on just I don't like that phrase snapshot or dipstick. I hear those words a lot, that we can just take a freeze frame of 1 second. Have you ever taken a freeze frame of yourself from a video or taken a video and then scrolled through and looked at your own face when you've taken a video? Like none of them look good, right? Like if you sit there and smile, like this face will not appear in the video. It's always going to be like some weird thing. And I think that's true for teacher practice too, that if you just try to take a freeze frame or a snapshot, it's never going to look all that great. And what we're evaluating ultimately is the teacher's overall practice for the year. And I just see so many exceptions to that. I see so many schools that are trying to evaluate teachers with these snapshots. And it's like, there's a reason your yearbook uses posed pictures rather than just like we went through videos of everybody's classroom and got them talking and with weird expressions on their face. Like it just doesn't work. And it doesn't work when we're evaluating practice either. Okay, enough on that little little tangent there. In some of these conversations, if we're talking about levels of performance, or we're trying to kind of hone in on where a teacher's practice falls on our rubric, one of the things we're going to have to accept, because we have such small slices of evidence, is a degree of non-closure. We're not really going to conclusively know exactly where a teacher falls based on any given observation, any given classroom visit. So we've got to be willing to kind of put off that question till the end of the year. It's okay to have a hunch. It's okay to say, boy, based on this conversation today, I am really worried about this teacher's ability to use formative assessment to adjust throughout the lesson. I feel like they've got an idea going into it and they don't really deviate from that based on how the students respond. I feel like this teacher has a lot of work to do in that area. But we've also got to be willing to say, okay, they've got the year. We've got some work to do together. I am not making the final evaluation today. I do want to get a sense of like where this is headed and how much the teacher needs to grow in order to be satisfactory at the end of the year. But that's very different from saying, today, teacher, you are basic, or today you are unsatisfactory. that's not the way that these instruments are designed to be used. They're designed to be worked up to over a long period of time. And I think one of the big informational pieces that we get from getting into classrooms frequently is we get a sense of where everybody is. And that keeps us from planning PD that people don't need. It keeps us from planning PD that people aren't ready for. And it allows us to differentiate much more effectively because we know kind of where people are on all these different dimensions intuitively, but it's also in your notes as well, even without any kind of scoring. Now, speaking of scoring and rating, you know, it's always going to be the case that people, I'm just gonna say it, have inflated opinions of themselves. I don't know if that happens in your schools, but you have anybody with inflated opinions of themselves? I think we all have inflated opinions of ourselves, frankly. I can remember a few things where I thought I wasn't very good at them, but I think probably in most things, I had an inflated opinion of myself most of the time. I think that's just human nature it's that we don't want to be too hard on ourselves. You know, it's an important part of our professional identity to think of ourselves as competent. So there's going to be some conflict. There's going to be some disagreement anytime we're looking honestly at evidence and those criteria serving as the law or the arbiter or the standard of performance, especially since we have incomplete evidence, right? We're only seeing, 0.1 to maybe 1% of a teacher's total practice. So we're not going to have complete information. But I think the general idea is the more we can kind of postpone that final judgment and the more we can triangulate between the evidence and the framework in the meantime, the better a position we're going to be in. What are some of your thoughts about those disagreements or people who do have maybe a persistently inflated opinion of their practice? Because we want those people to grow. We don't want them to just say, I'm mediocre, but I'm going to tell you that I'm good and therefore I don't have to grow. I don't know. What are some of your thoughts on that issue or that challenge of people having inflated opinions of their practice? Love to hear from some people on that.
I think sometimes when a teacher is, and maybe in the field, say you're in high school and they're, my background's in chemistry, so it helps me
too.
To go into those classrooms and have some of that knowledge base when they're providing the instruction. But maybe my knowledge base isn't in mathematics. So going in there and they think that they know more than you, and really you're just evaluating the instructional techniques or strategies they're using. So I think sometimes it depends, really, it really is teacher dependent on their perception of themselves and how you can engage in having a good trust relationship with them, where they know you're not there to get them for anything. So I think that's one of the biggest parts, which I really love, making sure that we're developing strong relationships at the beginning so they know that we're there to support them and help them. That may be able to help us deal with some of the disagreements that come our way.
Very well said. Thank you, Jennifer.
I think one of the biggest things I've encountered with inflated opinions of themselves as teachers who've been in the profession for 20 years. I've been doing this for 25 years. They feel like they know it. They know everything. And they don't want to, I don't want to say they don't want to grow, but they feel like they don't need to grow because they've been in it so long. And that's one of the biggest challenges I've seen with the inflated opinions, because sometimes you run into teachers who've been in it a long time, but they're still at the same level with the teachers who may have been in it 2, 3, 5 years, and they don't see it. But like Jennifer said, building those relationships can help. But sometimes it's hard to build a relationship because they have a wall up because of their experience level or how long they've been in the profession.
Yeah, absolutely. Very well said. And that's rational. I think we've got to remember that's rational on their part. That defensiveness, that wall serves a purpose. Right? It's, I don't want to get fired. I don't want to look dumb, so there's a reason for that. And, this is a kind of a central challenge in helping people get better. So that shared language can make a huge difference here. Looking at the action challenge for chapter 13, you do want to make sure that you're gathering any documents. And specifically, I want to encourage you, send me any documents that you think you might want to have the language imported from into your repertoire account. We can talk about how to actually do that, get that language in there so that you can use it start using that leveled language to describe practice. You don't have to do any kind of rating, but use that language when you're talking about practice as you get into classrooms. All right, that is it for chapter 13. We've got two to go. And like I said, at the end, we'll try to pull up some frameworks here and look at some of their language. Chapter 14 is all about developing skills for high impact conversations. And we talk about a couple of different angles on that in this chapter. First of all, there's the idea that both of us should be better off after one of these conversations, right? The teacher should have enjoyed it and have benefited from it. You should have enjoyed it and benefited from it. This should not be any kind of unpleasant process most of the time, right? This should just be beneficial and enjoyable. And if it's a good conversation, there are some things that you're getting out of it, and there are some things that the teacher's getting out of that. So let me know in the chat, what are some of the things that you get out of a good conversation? What do you take away from a good conversation with the teacher? And what does the teacher get out of a good conversation? We've already talked about being a sounding board. You know, the teacher gets someone to bounce their ideas off of. The teacher gets some recognition. They get to be noticed by another grown-up, somebody who can actually appreciate all of the hard work that they're putting in. What else do you and the teacher get out of those good conversations? So that they can be win-win. Learning more about their practice, Jennifer says. Valerie says the teacher gets to be transparent and feels comfortable asking questions. Love it. What else do you get out, or does the teacher get out of those conversations? I think one other thing that we should both get out of it is a stronger relationship and more trust. Right? If I know the teacher better, yeah, Valerie says I get to know the teachers more. You know, knowing that they are known better by their administrators is incredibly valuable for teachers' trust and their sense of safety. And yeah, just so many good things happen when we have those good conversations. All right, we talked a little bit about teachers requesting feedback, which may not happen very often. But in chapter 14, I address the scenario where the teacher does say, hey, come in my classroom. I'd love some feedback on this. As Jennifer said, often they just want to be recognized. They just want to show off a little bit, and that's great. But if you are asked to provide feedback on something specific, a couple of cautions on that are, you know, you want to stay really, really focused on what the teacher asked you for feedback on and not see it as just a license to criticize. I think that can really crush the relationship. So we want to really stay focused on what they've asked for feedback on. And unless you see something that's just like really terrible, just stay focused on that, because there are always going to be 10 other things you can focus on. But if we've been invited, you know, it's so rare to be invited in to give feedback on something. I think we've just got to make the most of that and keep it focused. I talked in the last chapter about how defensiveness is rational and about how it's our job to prevent defensiveness, not teachers' job to just not be defensive. It's a natural reaction. And I think we've got to really understand the place they're coming from, both within the day and within this position in the hierarchy of being evaluated by us. So a couple of things that you can do to set your conversations up for success: minimize that fear, make sure that the teacher is actually in a space mentally to have a good conversation. First, make sure they like got to get a drink of water and go to the bathroom, right? Ask, is this an okay time? Not, I've caught you, you're here, I'm standing in the doorway, so haha, you have to talk to me. But really giving the teacher permission to say no, or like, can you come back later, or can we talk tomorrow or after school? Ask, is this an okay time? Get the teacher to set the direction to some extent some of the time. You may bring up a piece of evidence, but you may let the teacher decide where to kind of run with that. I don't think it works very well to ask just a very vague question like, hey, how do you think it went today? I think we do have to set some focus or boundary around the discussion by referring to some evidence. I think it's okay to kind of trail off and not really ask a question once you've set that direction. Sometimes we get the most out of people when we just kind of let them run and, you know, see where their thinking is with the lesson. And it's not that they will necessarily always run in a productive direction, but sometimes it tells you what you need to know about their thinking, right? Like if you see a lesson where the content is just top-notch, right? The math content, that teacher knows it cold. They know their math. They know it all the way up through calculus. They know all the math that you've forgotten, I forgot since college, but their class just isn't with them, right? They have no sense of whether the students are paying attention. The kids are all on their phones. Like if you bring something up and the teacher runs in a totally different direction that lets you know that they totally missed this huge thing about student engagement or, you know, having the attention of the class, then you can say more specifically, you know, I noticed that this group of kids was, you know, spending a lot of time looking at their phones. What did you think about that? What were your thoughts about engaging that group of students? You can bring it back if they miss something huge, but allowing them to kind of run a little bit with what's on their mind can clue you in, you know, especially to things that just might not be at the front of their mind as far as awareness. I think especially people who are secondary teachers, again, I was a secondary teacher, we tend to be content focused and we tend to allow a lot of things with kids to go over our heads sometimes if we're not really intentional about them. And I remember having to really have it brought to my attention how to, you know, to keep track of those things that were not content. Like that was hard for me to learn as a new teacher because I was so content focused. So if you have content focused people, you may see that happening. All right, a couple of things that I think are not in the book, but I think are worth mentioning here in chapter 14. Have we talked about the different adopter types, like early adopters, later adopters? Remind me, Jennifer, what have I said about early adopters and late adopters and all that? We talked about that in the first session, maybe?
I don't recall. I don't know. I'm very familiar with this because I think every school deals with the very few innovators and then the laggards. Those ones are very, very identifiable on campus for sure.
Yeah. So there's not a lot in this book. We talked about this a little bit in Heather and my next book. But you know, one of the things we're going to see as we get into different classrooms is just that people make changes to their practice in a particular order socially. Like some people have to be first, some people have to be last, some people will always be at the middle. And I put this in here just to say, don't let that frustrate you too much, right? This is a natural distribution. It occurs everywhere in all societies, in all populations of people, that some people change first and some people don't. And you know, just kind of know who you're dealing with when it comes to trying to get people to change their practice, and know that you can't really change that order, right? Whoever is going to go last on this initiative is probably going to go last on the next initiative. They're never going to be the one to jump on some new opportunity. They're always going to go kicking and screaming. And we can still bring about change, you know, in everybody's practice. It just might have to happen in a certain order based on those kind of adopter personalities. So don't want to dwell on that too much, but chapter 14 does have some tips on kind of getting around defensiveness. Hope you found that valuable. And I think we'll spend the rest of our time on chapter 15 on some of the toughest conversations. I'd love to know, as we get into chapter 15 here and as we start to kind of wrap things up, what were some of your thoughts about those tough conversations? We've talked a little bit about if people disagree with you as far as where they are, if they have an inflated self-opinion. What other tough issues have you experienced, or do you maybe anticipate experiencing this year as you get into conversations with teachers? So let me know in the chat if you would, or if you have one that you'd like to talk about, you can unmute. What are some tough issues, some ways that conversations maybe can go sideways, some ways that they can be made unpleasant? One that I found wasn't super unpleasant, but was just kind of a challenge to deal with, is I had one older teacher who would just like stop the class every time I walked in, and then they would all stand up and say, "Good morning, Mr. Bader." And I'd like have no idea what they were doing because they had stopped to put on this little, like, aren't we all, you know, bright and shiny learners here, little show for me. So I had to like talk to the teachers, hey, like, don't do that. Like, just carry on when I walk in the room. Like, I just want to see what everybody's doing. Don't stop and greet me. So there's a little bit of that can be difficult. What else here? Let me know in the chat if you would. What are some of the difficult conversations that you run into? Yeah, Valerie says people who know it all already, they're not growing, their students aren't growing. Yeah, those walls are up. Just that kind of non-growth mindset, kind of defensiveness. Another thing I see sometimes is people like to philosophize. I don't know, like I had male teachers who like to do this, especially where it's like, oh, Justin, I really want to talk about my education philosophy and kids these days. And, you know, like it would never be about their practice. It would always be about like they were writing a paper for a grad school class or something. And it was fun. You know, it's fun to talk about education philosophy. At least I think it's fun. But it didn't often have anything to do with their practice, which is what we needed to be talking about. Yeah, blaming students, emotional reactions. Yeah, blaming parents, making excuses for different things. Like, there are lots of ways that those conversations can avoid talking about practice and can avoid talking about the set of things that are actually within the teacher's control. I think that's where we want to steer the conversation back if it's getting off track. We want to talk about the teacher's actual practice, not the kids, not the parents, not factors outside of our control, not the state government or the state Department of Education. We want to focus on the teacher's practice when in doubt. And I think one of the best ways to do that is to refer to specific evidence, right? And avoid those vague questions. How's it going? Oh, it's terrible because the state education department just blah, blah, blah. Okay, well, that's not what we need to talk about, right? We want to talk about the evidence. And a great type of question that you want to that you might find helpful in some of these conversations is to not ask why did you do something, but to ask how. How did you decide, or how did you approach this? What went into that decision? Because what you want here is not justification. You don't want excuses. You don't want that kind of defensive explanation. You want the thinking, right? You want the rationale. You want the kind of insider's view of practice that only happens when people aren't being defensive. So how questions can be a good way to do that. So a little bit on the chapter 15 action challenge. You know, you may not have these difficult conversations right now. It may be that they happen in the future. If you do have some difficult conversations with, you know, if you get into someone's classroom and they just react very negatively, they don't like you being there, they get very defensive or whatever it may be, I would love to hear from you. Please let me know as that starts. Like, it'll happen at some point. So please let me know what happens. Anybody got one? Anybody have a difficult conversation they want to share? Or just a situation where somebody is maybe not super receptive to having you in their classroom, or maybe not really excited to engage in conversation with you. Anybody got one? And I'm going to pull up the framework that Shanita sent me earlier. We can take a look at that. What kind of difficult conversations should we talk about? All right, let me find this link here. Let's see. Oh yeah, Shanita, you emailed it to me. Sorry, I'm looking in the wrong place here. All right, I'm gonna pull up something that, if I can find it, yep, here it is. And I'm gonna take down my slides here so I can put these on the screen here. All right, so this is, here, we'll open this up. I know we're about out of time here, but I just wanted to have a document for us to look at together. Let me reshare my screen just a second here. All right, so this is, all right, everything moves around here. Can you see that? Alabama Continuum for Teacher Development. Shanita, you said your district is in the process of adopting a new evaluation system. Is that right? So there's kind of some uncertainty about what they're going to go with.
Yeah, we're in a holding pattern right now. At first they told us we're going to use our old instrument from last year, and then they said to wait on doing anything with it. So we're like in a holding pattern, and nobody's really saying if we're using something else or we're going to keep the same thing.
Okay. Yeah. And, you know, those changes occur every couple of years, and there is definitely a period of limbo as well as a learning curve. So what I wanted to take a look at here was just how you can use this language, even if you're not sure if it's going to be your actual evaluation criteria. And I have not looked at these previously. You sent these to me today, and I looked over them just very briefly. I was actually at Starbucks just driving home today from Nashville. But, you know, we see things like content knowledge, teaching and learning, diversity, professionalism. What you want to do as you look through these is just look for words that you can use to describe what you're seeing, like vocabulary to use in description. And again, we're not worried about assessing. We're not worried about evaluating at this point. We're just interested in using this vocabulary to describe what we're seeing. So you've got things like connects curriculum to other content areas in real life settings, designs instructional activities based on state content standards, provides accommodations, modifications, and adaptations. Like, all of this is vocabulary that we can use to describe what we're seeing and to talk about what we're seeing with teachers more specifically and with more nuance. And I think it's a characteristic of all of these that there's a lot of language. Like, every framework now has so much language, right? There's just pages and pages and pages. This is what, like a 40 page document, I think. Or no, actually this one's not that bad, 16 pages. So 16 pages is still a lot of text. There's a lot here. But if you were to use this over and over again throughout the year with, you know, in 500 different classroom walkthroughs, you're going to be in incredible shape by the end of the year. You are going to know this stuff cold. And if the new criteria are different, they're not going to be so different that it's not pretty easy to make the translation, because you've gotten into classrooms, you've used that specific vocabulary. And what we can do in repertoire is we can talk about what specific language to import, right? What to put into your snippets. So you could always, highlight, copy and paste right into an observation. That's certainly a thing you can do. You can paste right into a snippet, but we can also import this for you. So if you have language, and I know, Jennifer, you talked about your network having documents that you've developed, we can import those for you. We can import those for anyone in your organization. And often we will make a like an Excel spreadsheet to import to everybody's account within a district so that they can use that same language. And even if you don't actually write out that, that criteria, use that whole chunk of text, you can at least look at it and think, okay, how does that help me notice certain features that are either present or absent in what I'm seeing here in this classroom? So really it becomes, not just, we talked about framework language as the law. We talked about it as, kind of the arbiter, but it can also be a lens and allow you to see more sharply what it is that you're looking at because you have that specific vocabulary. So we have a whole book coming out on framework language, how to develop framework language, how to use framework language. That'll be out probably early next year. We just got our due date for the next draft. Heather and I are going to get that done toward the end of next month, and hopefully we'll have an update for you on that book. But I'd love to talk with you more about this individually if you have framework language that you'd like us to import. So please send it my way. That is all the time we have. I'm sorry to keep you a little bit long today, but thank you so much for bearing with me. I know we got a little bit of a delayed start, and thank you to Shanita for letting everybody know that I would be back, had not been abducted by aliens, and we were able to get to everything. We've got one more week. Very excited to finish the book with you. We'll do 6 chapters next week. So finish that audiobook if you've not done so. If you don't have a copy of the book, please let us know. Send me an email. We'll make sure that we mail you one. Everybody should have a copy by now. So if you, for some reason, didn't get a copy of the book when you joined or didn't get one, in the meantime, please let us know. We'll send you one. Those note cards that you've got, now's a great time to set up your note cards if you haven't done that yet. If you need some note cards, let us know. We'll send them to you. I've ordered 10,000 in the last month. We're happy to get them out of here and send them to you. And then if you have anything you'd like us to import into repertoire, like a staff roster or a framework, just let me know and we'll make it happen. Shanita, thank you so much. Jennifer, thank you so much. All right, going on a little trip. Good deal. All right, well, we will get the recording out as always. We'll record next week's as well. So however you need to tune in, that would be great. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful week. Please take care of yourself. Get some sleep, drink some water, try to eat lunch before 4 o'clock, and have a good one. Take care. Bye. Thanks, everybody.